Right, so are we ready to go?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so let's do it.
Okay. Well, hello, I'm Simon Mercep, and welcome to the 50th, yes, the 50th episode of Crave. This is the podcast dedicated to music and film, television, theatre, just about anything that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe lately.
50? Seriously? I mean, who would have thought it? So if you've been with us all the way along, thank you very much. If you've only recently joined us, welcome aboard.
Yes, please. That would be a good idea. Now, look, a lot to squeeze into our half-century show, Steve. We're going to start with a young woman, rather well-known in this neck of the woods. She swept all before her in the New Zealand Music Awards. We'll chat about Lorde's show at the Power Station this week.
Simon's got a few thoughts about the forthcoming album from another young New Zealand singer-songwriter. That will be Marlon Williams.
Indeed, and Steve's been to see the follow-up to the pretty successful American comedy film Bad Moms, Bad Moms 2.
At least we think that's what it's called. We'll discuss that later.
Yes.
Now, on safer ground than that, Simon's cast his eye across what, by all accounts, is a very cleverly told serial killer series on Netflix called Mindhunter.
Steve's just back from the Kenneth Branagh-helmed remake of Murder on the Orient Express.
And we've both, for our sins, been to see the latest superhero outing from the DC Comics world, Justice League.
We have. But let's start with Lorde. I guess she's the closest thing we've got to an international superstar right now. This year, as Steve and I, we've discussed earlier this year, Steve, that his second album, Melodrama, she's been here in recent days, not just to accept a whole armful of music awards, the TUI Music Awards, but she's also been playing to her hometown audiences. Now, if you've visited our CravePodcast.com website lately, you will have seen a great collection of photos from Steve, who was there at one of the Power Station shows in Auckland. Steve, I couldn't make it, but you and Debbie were both there to see one of the Power Station shows. So, Debbie, hi, welcome to you.
Hi, Simon. Thank you.
Well, look, let's just get your first impressions of this show. I know you were very keen to see Lorde. Did she live up to what you were expecting?
She was fantastic. I loved the show. It was a great venue too.
Okay, that's a good starting point. Loved it in what way? Was the songs, the way the show was produced? What was it that really got you?
I think everything was great about the show. The venue was one of my favorites because of the small size, and I was right up there at the stage, which was great. Lorde was fantastic. She looked amazing. She sounded amazing. She had, I think it was three or four costumes, which were beautiful. They were stunning. They looked like they were made very specifically for her. She had a lot of energy. She danced. She sang her heart out. She was really right there with the audience, which is also part of the venue, I think.
Yeah, I guess the audience were right there with her, I'm sure.
Yes.
Singing to some of the songs?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Everyone was really, really singing and dancing and getting into it.
Okay. So I'm kind of interested because she's been around for, a year or two. She's only 21. She's still very young, but she's got a few years on the road and away from New Zealand. How did she strike you as someone on stage? How comfortable was she in front of the crowd?
She was very comfortable in front of the crowd. I think she was especially happy to be back in Auckland. And she, a few times, she just said, "I can't believe I'm at the Power Station."
Right. And what about just her stage craft, if you like? Because I've seen on videos in some of the shows, I think some of the live award shows where she's done, or TV shows where she's done some songs, she has quite a energetic, dramatic sort of dancing style, kind of a little quirky, a little offbeat. Did she demonstrate any of that at all?
Yep, that sounds exactly like what I saw at the Power Station. She was quirky, she was energetic, and she looked like she was having a great time, which I think just, went to the crowd to make them have a great time as well.
What was her voice like live?
Her voice sounds very much like she sounds recorded. I've often wondered, because I have never seen her live. So I had often wondered, how much was her voice compressed or, altered for, when she does recordings. But it turns out that she sounds basically the same live, only much more powerful.
Yeah. Did she talk much to the audience?
She did. Yeah, she talked to us quite a bit, I suppose. She was really excited to be in Auckland. I can't emphasize that enough.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah. Actually, well, that raises an interesting question because we think of her as, you know, very much a New Zealand performer, but she has spent quite a bit of time away from here, and I think she worked in New York to record that most recent album, and I guess she's mixing with Americans particularly. Did she seem still like a Kiwi person, or was she more of an internationalist now?
Well, maybe a bit of both. I mean, she still seemed very Kiwi, but maybe she's been a little bit more internationalized or possibly Americanized. Her accent maybe was a little bit more Americanized. Not much. I think she's still a Kiwi girl.
Steve, you were there not just to photograph, but you caught the concert as well. What about you? What did you make of it?
I think Deb has summed it up fairly well, to be honest. Yeah, I mean, this is a young woman who's clearly delighted that she's playing in a significant venue in her hometown. I mean, don't forget, this was the second of the three nights she was playing in Auckland. The first night, there'd been a complete balls-up with licensing at the power station, and she'd had to relocate, I think, about 48 hours notice to the Bruce Mason Centre in Takapuna. Yeah. And so this was the first time she'd ever played at a venue that clearly meant an awful lot to her. And I don't think anybody was enjoying the show quite as much as she was.
Yeah,
I would amazing. Agree.
Yeah. Just one other question I wondered. The album, the second one particularly, that you and I talked about, Steve, it's a very well-produced album. There's obviously a bit of post-production work that went into it. When you hear it live, is it just the musicians on stage and Lord, or does it appear as if there were some pre-recorded backing tracks going on there?
You know, I was thinking about that as I was listening to her, and it's hard to tell. I mean, her voice, as Deb said, you know, you're wondering how much of the post-production is going to be applied when she's singing, and her voice sounded like it was allowed to fly freely, and her voice sounded wonderful, but there were moments when it sounded like there were pre-recorded backing vocals. She had a live band.
She did,
There was a drummer, there was a keyboard player on stage with her. And certainly when she played Royals, there was a drum accompaniment, which was really quite powerful, quite impressive, that picked out the underlying rhythm to Royals. From where I was standing, I couldn't quite see. I'm assuming it was probably the bass drum. But yeah, there were moments when you wondered where some of the sounds were coming from. But her voice was all her.
Yeah. Well, that's what most people wanted to hear, of course. So
yes.
Sounds like a fantastic night out. Well, Debbie, thank you very much for... Oh, you got something else to add?
I did have one last thing to add. There was a point fairly far into the concert where she came down into the pit and leaned into the crowd, and people just went crazy, mostly girls, mostly women, kind of went crazy, and she just let everyone basically touch her, and, you know, kind of, she seemed to really enjoy that, and the crowd loved it, so just thought I'd add that.
Yeah, fantastic.
Fun. Yeah.
Oh, well.
A little different.
Well, it sounds like we love her. That sounds great.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, Debbie. Thank you for going along for Craig. We really appreciate that.
Okay, you're quite welcome. Thanks, Ivan.
You gonna sing this one with me, Auckland? I've never seen a diamond in the flesh. I've got my teeth on wedding rings in the movies, and I'm not proud of my address in the torn up town. No postcode envy, but every child's like gold teeth, grey goose dripping in the bathroom, bloodstains, ball gowns, stress in the hotel room. We're driving Cadillacs in our dreams, but everybody's like crystal Maybach, diamonds on your timepiece, jet planes, islands, tigers on a gold leash. We don't care, we aren't caught up in your
so that was Lord live. And a reminder, please go to our website, cravepodcast.com, because Steve was there with his camera getting some great shots of the concert and some great photos of Lord in action. You can go there to see that. Now, let's move on, shall we, Mr. McCabe?
I think we should, yes.
Yes. You know, out this week in our No Matter Where You Turn, A Superhero Is Staring You in the Face department.
Yes.
A new offering, this time from the DC Comics movie machine. This is Justice League. I should add, if you've been following us for a bit, you'll have picked up that I'm generally well-disposed to the Marvel films and somewhat less so to the DC stable. Steve, I think you're quite even-handed in your criticism, aren't you? Is Justice League a winner for you?
Well, I mean, to be absolutely fair, it's only reasonable to point out that I'm not a monstrous fan of the genre in yes. general. But you remember last time we spoke, I found many positive things to say about Thor Ragnarok. Because that was entertaining. It genuinely yes. was. Yeah. But I mean, there were two moments. We'll just get this out of the way from right at the start. Two moments in Justice League, which incidentally involves virtually no justice whatsoever. At the very beginning, when you're getting the opening titles, it does say a cruel and unusual production. And I'm thinking, you really shouldn't have a film review itself like that quite so bluntly.
Okay.
So that's how it starts. And there's a moment, not long into it, where... Yeah. A character who we eventually find out is going to be the Flash goes to visit his father.
Yes, that's right.
In prison. Now, I wrote down, I'm looking at my notes here, because I wrote down a comment that the father said. I'm going to find it now, because I thought it was kind of relevant. Oh, God, I've lost it. That's right. The father says, when his son visits him in prison, he says, "Please don't come and see me again. I'm a drag on your life." And again, I'm thinking, the film should not review itself like this. That could be a motif for the entire franchise, right there. So,
yeah.
So unfortunately,
yeah, okay.
that's how I felt about this. I mean, look, 2 hours of lots of things happened, and then it stopped. And yes. And I'm sorry, that's all I got out of it.
Yeah, all right, okay. I get what you're saying. I just posted a review on our website, and you're welcome to go and have a look at that. I thought, I guess it depends what you're comparing it to, doesn't it? I thought that two of its predecessors, in particular Suicide Squad that you and I both saw, and Batman versus Superman, were pretty awful,
yes.
to put it mildly. They took themselves, or Batman versus Superman took itself way too seriously. Suicide Squad was just bleh. So I thought compared to those... I thought this was better than those, because I think there was an attempt, I use the word attempt, to foster some sort of self-deprecating humor. And you mentioned the character The Flash, played by Ezra Miller. He was probably the closest one who tried to get some light relief going in the film. And the Aquaman character, a little less so. But so I thought, yeah, a mark or two better than those two earlier films for me, but still quite a way short, a considerable distance short from Wonder Woman, which seemed to gel quite well. So it's almost not worth mentioning the story, Steve. It seemed to be another rehash of previous sort of invasions from another dimension with a big bad villain who looked like a bit of a mishmash of all other big bad villains you've seen in other similar films. And the story was almost not that important. It was just a way, an excuse of getting this group of characters together, was it not?
Well, yeah, I mean, there was notionally a story, like you say. It's the same old thing of some sort of monsters from a different dimension led by somebody who is non-specifically evil. We don't quite know why he's evil. We just know that he is evil in some
this is
evil
Steppenwolf,
way.
Is his name.
Is it Steppenwolf? Yes. I mean, I don't know what happened to. I was thought a bit of a one-hit wonder, really.
You know,
after Born to Be Wild, I don't really know what he did, and now we found out. To be fair, yeah.
Can we know where he went? Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it was just rubbish, basically.
Well, I mean, I think the thing that where maybe I think the Marvel films have generally done better is that they've been able somehow in the writing or the presentation of these characters, given them a bit of a human edge or given you a bit of depth to the character. I'm not talking about Oscar-winning stuff here, but they've given you something to latch on to as the audience. And I think they tried to do it a little bit here with using some of the other characters who weren't superheroes. Amy Adams was there again as Lois Lane, and Diane Lane was the Superman's mother, and you just mentioned the father, that's Billy Crudup playing the father of the Flash. And I guess they were there to try and round out these characters a little bit. I guess they went a little bit down that road, but the story was so predictable. There were many flat and plodding parts of the film. I thought the particular Batman just didn't work for me at all. I thought he was extremely flat because he's a very broody sort of a character anyway. He just didn't seem to fit into the idea of a team that's going to be sparking off each other and having a few laughs. That didn't work for me at all very well.
No, he did the usual thing of, I'm the Batman. And that's it. That's all he manages.
Yeah.
And he just plodded along. I mean, you know, the film breaks down into two parts. And I don't think this is going to be a massive spoiler because, you know, it was in the post and everything. Superman comes back. We always knew he would because, you know, he's Superman. So you basically got the first hour is... The League's coming together and they're trying to fight Steppenwolf.
Yes.
And, you know, they're trying to get their motor running. I can't help it. You just have to. The moment you call the character Steppenwolf, this is where you're going to get taken. But, you know, and so, you know, they head out on the highway. And they're not doing too well against him. There's a wee bit of a fight and it ends.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the first hour. And then in the second hour, they bring Superman out. Superman headbutts Wonder Woman.
Yes.
Which in itself is just, you know, odd. And then they go off and they go to Russia for reasons that are never clearly explained because there's some nonsense about there's three MacGuffins. Three mother boxes, or if I remember those.
Yeah, yes, that's
you, you
right,
reach the
yes.
point where you're not even paying attention any longer.
It doesn't really matter.
There's one that's unaccounted for, and at one point, there's something that is, to all intents and purposes, one of these mother boxes that's being used to resurrect Superman in
yes.
Gotham Metropolis, wherever it's called. But then apparently, at the same time, it's in Russia.
The three of them, remember?
Yeah, but they already counted. You see,
yeah.
If you and I can't be clear on the details here, then if they didn't take the trouble to make a good film, we can't take the trouble to give it a good review. I think.
But here's the funny. Here's an interesting thing. Just yeah, not too bogged down. But I was looking at the credits of this afterwards, Steve. There's many executive producers. One of them was Christopher Nolan. He of the original Batman trilogy and many good films, and involved in the screenplay was Joss Whedon. An acclaimed writer and director who directed the first Avengers film, which was hugely successful. You kind of wondered in the end how much influence those guys had, because basically this was the same team that did the Batman versus Superman and the Suicide Squad.
Yes, yeah.
And both of those pretty awful films made hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. One suspects this will also make a lot of money, but I would slightly disagree with you. I think it will probably slightly... persuade some critics that they're making a move in the right direction. I thought it was just a very small step, but still not a great film in this genre by any means, I think.
Well, it's worth mentioning the people responsible for this thing. Zack Snyder, as you say, was also the director of Suicide Squad. Apparently he's going to be the producer of Suicide Squad 2. Dear God, they're making another one. And so, as a result, you know, if you remember, one of the things that made Suicide Squad, the original film, stand out was the lingering attention it paid to Margot Robbie's ass. To the extent it should have had its own line in the credits. Because that's what Zack Snyder does. Oh, there's a woman in the film, I'll just focus on her bottom. And the same was, it wasn't quite as bad this time round. Because, you know, ensemble cast. And, you know, to be fair, Gal Gadot as is mentioned at one point, she is gorgeous and she has a very pleasant bottom. Again, an awful lot of lingering on it. Come on, Zach, you can do better than that, mate.
Yeah, yeah.
Joss Whedon apparently was rolled in to do a rewrite.
Right.
Up to a fifth of it. And you can always pick out the scenes that he must have written because they're the ones that have actually got a bit of... Well,
a little bit of pizzazz, a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, they sparkle a little bit because also the dialogue is lumpen and leaden and plodding. When Gal Gadot as Diana Prince has to do a little bit of exposition of what Steppenwolf's all about, it's ponderous. It's horrendous.
So,
quite frankly, Christopher Nolan ought to know better. As for that matter, should Amy Adams.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I thought, it's interesting. The odd little moments of genuine acting stand out, don't they? And I thought hers did. But yes.
Yeah.
Look,
before we go any further, by the way, did you pick out the three, count them, three Game of Thrones interactions?
Well, there was one Game of Thrones actor, at least I remember seeing, who was one of the bad guys getting out of the car right at the beginning in that heist scene.
Yes, indeed.
I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but Michael, he was Game of...
Michael McElhattan.
Yes, okay, yeah.
I mean, even if you don't recognise the face, the voice is unmistakable as Ramsay Bolton.
Yeah. Yes, that's right, the father of... Yes, that's right, yes. That's one I picked up, but I didn't pick up the other two.
Well, Aquaman.
Of course he was, Daenerys' husband for a while.
Yeah, for a while. Khal Drogo.
Drogo, yes, of course, yes.
But then the third one that you might not have realised was Steppenwolf.
Ah, I don't know how to pronounce his name. Is it Kieran? How do you say his name?
I believe it would be Kieran, wouldn't it? Kieran Hines,
yes.
Who was Mance Rayder in Game of Thrones.
Ah, the pervasive tentacles of Game of Thrones, eh?
It's a phenomenon, isn't it, really, yes.
Anyway, I think if you are a fan of this genre, you're probably going to see it anyway. And I think you'll think it was a minor step forward. But like you, Steve, if you're not particularly interested in this type of genre, I don't think this is going to make you change your mind in any way, shape or form. It'll drive you further away, probably.
Well, I mean, you know, if the best you can say about it is it's better than Suicide Squad.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it might be the best I can say.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, Ebola is better than Suicide Squad. You're not setting the bar as high as you might there. I took my daughter to see it, and she is a fan. She usually likes this kind of stuff.
And she
absolutely loved Wonder Woman.
She saw
it on two consecutive nights. She absolutely adored Wonder Woman. Yeah. And she came out and said, yeah, really not very good at all. I mean, Gal Gadot is far and away the best thing in it, obviously.
Yeah, she carries on where she left. And I'm sure they were hoping that there's some sort of momentum from that film was going to do good things for this. Anyway, I think we've dissected this well and truly. And
I mean, we could, frankly, keep on kicking this thing around the block all night because it deserves it, to be honest. I mean,
again, I'm going to say I'm slightly take issue with you, but I can't generally disagree with what you say. However, can I just, I'm going to change the topic because...
Please do, please. Yes. It would be a mercy.
Because I want to have a good chat with you about this next film because I remember in my teens, Steve, I saw the 1974 film version of Murder on the Orient Express.
Right.
I remember that I had not read the Agatha Christie book. So that film was my first exposure to the story, and I remember thinking, "Oh, this is a good film." I have lots of big name actors of the day. Albert Finney was Poirot, and Sean Connery was there, and lots of other very well known actors. I thought it was very well directed and played. And I, not knowing what was coming at the end, it had a really good ending, a great twist. And I remember, you know, to this day, decades later.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, okay, they've remade it.
They have.
Well, If like me, you've seen the first film or you've read the book, there's no surprise coming, I take it, for you in the ending. So why bother going to see it?
Well, I have to tell you, I hadn't seen the original.
Ah,
I hadn't read the book. I went in cold.
So you had read the book? Or
No, I hadn't.
Oh, you completely cold. Okay.
Completely cold. I had no idea it was coming.
Right.
I knew it was set on the Orient Express, and I figured it was reasonable to assume that there was going to be a murder at some stage.
yes.
Beyond that, I was kind of, you know, ready to be impressed by this film. And I think I have to tell you, I was reasonably impressed.
I know first of all, it's a good story, isn't it? I think it's a good mystery, and it's got a good twist, and it draws you in very well. I mean, Agatha Christie did a good job with this.
Well, there's a reason why she cranked these things out. I mean, and there's a reason why we're still remaking her films, you know, decades on. She's highly competent. She knows what she's doing, and it turned out to be, you know, an entertaining old film. It really did.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I saw a trailer. It looked very well directed and produced, and the sets and the costumes look fantastic. They've got another fantastic group of actors together.
Oh, the cast is remarkable.
Yeah, yeah. But I just, can you, I don't know if it's possible, that if you saw it cold, and it's possibly, you may not be able to answer my question, that, you know, I would have gone into that film knowing what the ending was.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I would have, someone has suggested to me that they've slightly tweaked the treatment a little bit so that someone like me might still get something out of it. But
I have heard that said, yes.
The only way I'm going to know is whether I go and see it.
It's got Kenneth Branagh as Hercule Poirot.
Mm-hmm.
And seriously, that's about the level of French that we get from him. He chews the scenery, or he nibbles the scenery, to be fair. He doesn't really fully chew it, but you can tell the temptation's there. And he's having some fun. You know, at one point, somebody questions him about something, and he tries to make a joke, and he says, "Forgive me, I am Belgian." And, you know, it was not a film that took itself at all seriously. And that's part of the the joy of it.
Yes.
But then there's not enough joy. Mm-hmm. There are moments like when it starts to sparkle and the dialogue starts to really become a joy, and it never really quite manages to fully find its stride. But nevertheless, I mean, you've got an amazing cast.
Yeah.
You know, we'll start obviously with Sir Kenneth Branagh as Hercule. And then you've got Daisy Ridley that we last saw in Star Wars.
Right.
You've got Penelope Cruz. You've got Josh Gad, Johnny Depp as the wonderfully named Edward Ratchet. You've got Derek Jacobi's in it. Michelle Pfeiffer. Oh, who else is in it? Olivia Colman, Dame Judi Dench. You've got Willem Dafoe. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
This is an astonishing cast. Everybody and their dog, actually, quite literally.
Yeah, but just a quick point, because you mentioned about the script not necessarily sparkling there, but the tale, it's a pretty dark tale.
Yes.
I mean, I my memory of it is that there wasn't a lot of humour in the original film treatment either. It's a fairly, there's not a lot of light in this dark tale from memory.
No, there isn't. But like I said, when you've got Kenneth Branagh clearly having fun, he's hamming it up as Hercule, and he's having fun with it. You have to assume that there is... Like I say, no, it's not played for laughs. That would be unfair.
No.
But you do expect, you're offered the hints of a certain degree of soaringness to the dialogue, and just you think it's about to take flight, it then sort of like just cuts to a long, languorous scene of beautiful scenery and gorgeousness.
Right.
And
right.
It never, it just feels a little bit uneven. But it's a gorgeous film to look at.
Yes. Yeah. I'll bet. Oh, sorry. The $69,000 question here is, watching it for the first time, how much of an impact did the end make on you, the twist at the end? Did you think, wow, or did you think, oh, I saw that coming?
No, I did. Well, I did wonder if, well, in broad strokes, how the culprit was going to be identified.
Yes.
Then sort of the complex and convoluted backstory for it just about worked. But only just. But it's, I mean, the thing is, it's a film that an awful lot of people, as you say, have seen before, are very familiar with the story. So it's not about the destination.
Fair enough. It is.
It's about the journey. It really is. And the journey is done beautifully well. It's gorgeously filmed.
Yeah, yeah.
The big problem with it is because you've got, about a dozen suspects on the train.
Mm.
And it's a two-hour film. And quite frankly, the train doesn't leave the station, literally, until close to an hour into the film.
Oh, okay. Right.
And the murder, and I don't think there's any spoiler in saying there's a murder.
No.
The murder doesn't happen until halfway through.
Okay.
And so then, you've got your Denches and your Colemans and your all the rest, and they're not given enough time.
Right.
To really, I mean, you to be fair,
I've got it. Yeah.
Last time Judi Dench was given three lines in a film, she got the Best Actress Oscar. She's not quite that good this time, but you know, when you're rounding up such brilliant talent, you need to give them a bit more room to breathe.
Yeah. I've just got a great idea. It's just struck me. You know what you and I should do?
What's up?
In between now and our next podcast.
Oh yeah.
I will see this film.
Yeah.
And you find a way to get a DVD or something of the 1974 film.
Oh, that's a brilliant idea, yes.
And you and I should just look at the other versions, and just next time we should have just a little follow-up to see what we both thought of the different version.
What a fantastic idea. Yes,
I think we should.
A great idea.
All right, we'll do that. I'll make a note of that in my diary.
Absolutely.
Okay. So you've done enough to persuade me that I think I will take a look at it anyway, Steve. Just to see, you know.
I would recommend it. Put it this way, I've seen two films this afternoon. I've seen that and I've seen Justice League. And I'll tell you which one was the better one. And you can probably guess, can't you?
Yeah, I think I can. Yeah. Okay, very good.
Yeah.
So, okay, excellent. All right, well, we'll take that as a tick then.
I'll definitely buy a ticket for this one. Very definitely.
Okay.
Now, moving on to things that you don't need to buy a ticket for, you buy a subscription for. I'm getting good at this. It's only taken me 50 episodes. But,
yes.
We're a broad church here at Crave. And so we're including subscription-based TV these days as well, because let's face it, Netflix are cranking out some seriously high-end content.
Oh, they are.
And one that you and other friends, and obviously, you know, yours is the opinion I value most, but other opinions obviously are available, but they're all telling me to watch Mindhunter.
Yeah, and I think that's good advice you're getting from your mates there, Steve. I think it's this is a quality piece of entertainment, I think. Basically, it's a serial killer story. And yes, there have been a lot of those around for a number of years, haven't there? But there's several things going for this. First of all, the story. It's a little different than most of the other takes in this genre.
Oh, yeah?
This is basically the story of how, in the late 70s, the FBI first developed a team to deal with serial killers.
Oh, okay.
So, and it takes a couple of detectives and it shows them really almost stumbling into this job. There's an academic who helps them out along the way. And basically, they drive around the United States interviewing killers who are in prison, trying to figure out what makes them tick, what's going on in their minds, what was going on when that led up to these terrible crimes they've committed, and in the hope that they can discover a pattern that might help them catch future offenders.
Makes sense.
So it's an interesting premise.
Yeah.
The characters are very well written. The two main agents are, they're kind of... I think the writers have cleverly suggested here that, you know, if anyone who's interested in doing this as a job, you know, there's got to be something about you that's a little bit out of the ordinary to want to do this sort of work. So
I can see it would take a rather singular kind of personality.
Yeah. So the actor Jonathan Groff, he plays one of the agents called Holden Ford.
Now, there's a great name for you.
American name for you, isn't it? He's the younger of the two agents. He's an intelligent, bright, well-educated, extremely analytical guy. He'll take on authority, but he's rather socially inept. He's not relaxed. He's uptight. He wears suits and ties all the time. He's awkward around women.
So in other words, he kind of fits the profile for a serial killer.
Well, he might. And I think along the way, they kind of dangle that thought in the back of your mind very cleverly. Not saying that he would, but it just, they suggest that, you know, there must be something about this guy that lets him get in the mind of these other terrible guys and start to understand what they're doing. I think it's very well written. The other bloke is the character is called Bill Tench. He's played by an actor called Holt McEnany. He's more of a sort of traditional stand-up guy, but he's got hot problems at home, which beset him during the series, and he's also a well-defined character. These guys don't always get on. And Tench, the older guy, he often questions what the hell they're doing anyway. Is this a worthwhile project they've taken on? It's got an air of reality about it. The script is smart. It's quite realistic. There's a lot of profanity, at times incredibly confronting profanity.
Right.
In a way, like the Game of Thrones is sometimes. But it's not done in a histrionic way. It's done in a very matter-of-fact way that people talk, how they talk.
Yeah.
The subject matter is distasteful, it's violent, but they don't spend a lot of time showing you any violence, or at least the perpetration of violence. It's you might see photographs and stuff and talk about it, but it's not dwelling on the bloodletting in the depiction of it. But it remains incredibly gripping, even though there's a lot of talk in this. And it's especially the case when these two agents are interviewing these killers.
Right.
And they're having these sort of matter-of-fact conversations with a bloke who's just murdered half a dozen people in a most awful way. There's one of the serial killers, a character called Edmund Kemper. He's about 6'6", as big as a tank. He's played by an actor called Cameron Britton, and he almost steals it. In fact, he possibly does steal every scene he's in. It's a compelling performance. And the last thing to mention is the look and the tone of this is really high class. I thought four of the episodes are directed by a Hollywood director called David Fincher,
right?
Who did Fight Club and Seven, and I mean he's a high quality director. It's taking a subject matter in a way sometimes low key, but still compelling. It's better for being low key. I think it's incredibly recommended. Not always an easy watch, and if you are an easily offended person, it may not be for you. But I think you would like it, Steve. You got to be a little bit patient with it. Take your time with it. But I think it's a quality piece of work.
You've convinced me. I mean, I'm having a very quick look at the IMDb parents guide.
Right.
And there's definitely references to violence and gore. And quite frankly, I don't know how you're going to deal with the subject matter.
It doesn't shy from that at all. Yeah,
no, the same with the profanity, which is described as moderate.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
That's what it says. I guess in this post Game of Thrones world in which we live, maybe the bar has moved a little bit, but
well, I think it's not so much. You know what? It's not so much that there's a lot of effing and blinding. It's when it happens, it really hits you.
But again, when you're dealing with serial killers, your language is likely to be somewhat immoderate. I think there's a degree of inevitability to that.
I think there is. Yes. Yeah.
I can't imagine doing that job and going home going, gosh, that was a little bit challenging.
Yes. No, I think so.
Yeah, he was a dashed cad. He was a bit of a rotter.
He was. So they've set up a second series here. I think the second series, I'm hanging out for it. I'll be definitely watching the second series.
Well, you convinced me to give the first one a look. Definitely.
I think you should. So I think that's good, but pretty grim.
Yes.
And I
think
after that, you definitely want a bit of light relief. And I hope you're going to tell me that the second Bad Moms movie was just the light relief I might need.
Well, you know what? It might well be.
Okay.
Seriously. Did you see the first Bad Moms film?
Yeah, I did. And I generally laughed quite a bit at that.
Yeah, I mean, it was decent. It was a bit forced, I thought, in places. There was a little bit of, if one knob gag is funny, then 1,000 knob gags will be 1,000 times funnier. Yeah. And they for my money, forgot the idea of diminishing returns.
Yeah.
So what we've got now is we've got the same basic characters. We've got the three moms being bad, and we've established now that they are slightly kooky characters. We got Amy, Kiki, and Carla, Mila Kunis, right. Kristen Bell, and Catherine Hahn, and the gimmick that they've come up with for this one is that their moms are coming into town.
Okay, right.
So it's now bad grandmas as well, The grandmas are one-dimensional, caricatured characters who manage to actually be really quite funny at the same time.
Oh, there you go.
Are you a big fan of The Big Bang Theory?
I'm actually not. I'm just a program I've heard about a lot, but I've never really watched it. So if
I tell you that Leonard's mom is in this, that'll mean nothing to you. But if anyone listening is familiar with Leonard's mom, played by Christine Baranski, they'll know exactly what to expect of Amy's mom. Cheryl Hines plays Sandy, who is Kiki's mum, and again, cloying, cringeworthy. But Cheryl Hines is a very funny comic actor and puts a lot of humour into the character. And you've got Susan Sarandon having a brilliant time as Carla's mum, who basically shows up not because it's Christmas, but because she wants money.
Okay.
And incidentally, that's one issue that does come with the film, is we don't even know what this film is called. In some territories, it's Bad Moms 2. In some territories, it's A Bad Moms Christmas. And I think in New Zealand, they're going with Christmas, but we're not entirely certain. At any rate, the grandmas are coming into town for Christmas. And it's exactly what you'd expect. There's no discernible story other than each of the mother-grandmother pairs starts off with a huge rift between them and they have to come together before Christmas.
Oh.
And I'll let you figure it out for yourself whether you think they might or not. I know. I'm sowing the seeds of tension there.
You are.
But the thing is, right, there's actual humour in this one. They're not simply relying on, this knob gag seems to be funny, so we'll stretch it out for 5 minutes and just keep saying knob, knob, knob. Which in itself ceases to be funny after about the first minute.
Yes.
And you're just going, okay, fair enough, I see what you did there. They've actually managed to find proper gags, proper humour. Yeah, I mean, it's rubbish. Let's be honest with you. It's absolute nonsense. But they managed to make it entertaining rubbish.
That's
a challenge in itself, and they've done well. Mila Kunis is not the world's greatest comic actor.
Okay.
But she's an engaging presence. Kristen Bell, on the other hand, is a high-end comic actor, and I can watch her in very nearly anything. Yes. Catherine Hahn's not bad either, to be honest.
Okay.
If you're looking for something sophisticated, intellectual, really, really don't bother. The best way to watch this film is with a bottle of wine between the two of you.
Okay.
And probably a second bottle of wine before the film ends.
Okay. Right, fair enough.
But if you do that, you will have a really good time. It's stupid fun, but it's absolutely fun.
Okay, well, look, that's a great recommendation, because I think sometimes, Steve, that's just what you want is a bit of fun, and especially if you've seen something like Mindhunter, so I might need something like that.
I think you might want. You could do an awful lot worse. Now let's finish on another musical note. We started off with Lord, but since this is our 50th episode and we're packing in it, I mean, seriously, you know, even the two Ronnies would be able to be saying, "Wow, that's a bit packed for a program, isn't it?" I mean, we're gonna go back to music, and You've been listening to a new album and some live renditions therefrom, from Marlon Williams.
Yeah, Marlon Williams. He's pretty well known in these parts these days. Originally from Littleton in the South Island, singer-songwriter. He's just about to release his second album. It's called Make Way for Love. And what he's done in the last week or two, Steve, he's been around the country doing a few little sort of promotional concerts, and he did a special show in the glitzy suburb of Point Chef in Auckland at the RSA there. And what they did was they played four songs, he and his band, four songs live from the album, and then sat down and had a little Q&A chat with us assembled journalists. Crave was there as well. And I had seen him play earlier this year. He opened twice for Springsteen early in the last summer.
Yes.
And that was probably a pretty big audience. And I think he was playing a lot of stuff from his first album. The second album is, I think, we heard of it, I think it's going to be really, really good. He's clearly moving away from a country music label that some have attached to him. He does have a voice which it's a really identifiable. It's a beautiful voice, actually. Apparently he sang in a choir at school. He's got a strong, I was going to say, it's more than a sweet voice. It's a soulful voice that it worked well in country, but it could work well in other genres. Quite powerful, but quite emotional as well. He has a great band called the Yarra Benders, and he played four songs. They were called Come to Me, I Didn't Make a Plan, Nobody Gets What They Want Anymore.
Isn't that a great title for a song?
Nobody Gets What They Want. That's actually the first single, and there's a video out for that, and we've got a link to that on our cravepodcast.com website. He finished with the title track, Make Way for Love. The interesting thing about this album is, in terms of what it's about, it's basically a breakup record.
Oh, dear.
But it's not maudlin, from what we could hear anyway. And interestingly, the single, Nobody Gets What They Want Anymore, it's a duet with the woman he broke up with.
Oh, dear.
But interesting. But the trick there is that they weren't in the same studio together when they did that.
Why is that the terms of the restraining order?
I don't know. Her name is Aldous Harding, or
yes.
Hannah is her name. I think he was recording it offshore. I don't think she may be in New Zealand. Anyway, they did it. Not physically together, and maybe that's kind of a nice little commentary on what the album's all about. But he said in the Q&A afterwards, it was a great privilege to work with her again, and she's a genuine talent, which is fair enough. The music is quite dramatic, quite powerful, quite soulful. The ballad Nobody Gets What They Want Anymore is one of the other journalists who was there said she got quite teary eyed listening to it for the first time. But the bridge of the song has a little vocal treatment, sort of ba 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 ba, which made me think of Mamas and the Papas from the 1960s,
oh, wow.
Something like that. So he's mixing up all sorts of interesting flavors to the music, and the band all sing very, very well, and they're multi instrumentalists, and I think it's he's just maturing as a songwriter, musician. And he gave us a real treat at the end, Steve. I'll just quickly mention this last song called Make Way for Love. Now, if you have been around, if you're a New Zealander of a few decades under your belt, you will have been perhaps familiar with the tradition in this country, which I think started in the 40s and 50s and certainly carried on to the 60s, of the Māori show band. We had guys like Prince Tuiteka, Howard Morrison. It was almost like sort of a Las Vegas-style show band type music, a sort of Frank Sinatra type music, but with a lovely Māori way of expressing it with a lot of humour. His last song, when the guitar started strumming, my first thought was, this is a Māori show band strum going on here. And it was quite an uplifting, positive song called Make Way for Love. And it was they performed it beautifully. It evoked that other era, and he admitted as much later in the interview. And I think he's not a lord yet, but he is going off on an international tour around Europe and Australia, the USA, Britain over the next few months. He's appeared on programs like the British guy Jules Holland, Steve? He's been on his show, and he's been in Conan in the States late night. So I know, maybe he's about to launch into bigger and better things. I hope so.
And you were there at the start.
Ah, yes. So I think that your new album's out in February. It's called Make Way for Love. I will be definitely getting a copy of the whole album to have a listen to it. And I'll be interested to follow his career from now on. Truly.
Sounds fantastic. What's another act that you'll be interested in as we do a quick round of what's coming up in the near future?
Yes.
We've just discovered that Robbie Williams is going to be opened up in February by Tammy Nielsen.
Oh, okay. Sure. That's an interesting combination because she's also has that, a kind of a country vibe
and
reputation. But also a very strong voice.
You've spoken highly of her in the past, haven't you?
You hear her live and you're hearing a good singer, that's for sure. Yeah. Okay, well, that'd be good.
We've got the American rock superstars Paramore are going to be at Auckland Spark Arena on February the 13th.
Okay.
A British band called Kitty, Daisy and Lewis.
Don't know them. Ooh, no.
Brother and Sisters band. Okay. They're doing a bit of a national tour. They're going to be up in Auckland on the 11th of February next year. Apparently, they're very good. I've not seen them myself yet, but I gather they're an awful lot of fun. Biffy Clyro, hardcore British rock, well, Scottish to be exact, are going to be at Spark Arena on April the 24th. And I don't know if this is totally your tempo, Simon, but do you remember Boys to Men?
I didn't pay them much attention, to be brutally honest with you.
So you won't be there when they show up in Auckland in January?
I might be busy that day.
Fair enough, yeah. you'll be washing your hair, won't you?
Yeah, something's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, don't worry, they're also playing Christchurch, and they're co-headlining with TLC.
Oh, TLC, were they... sort of a punkish, new wave-ish band from way, way back? Am I thinking of if I got the right
not,
one?
Not even of... remotely.
No,
no
who
not,
am I thinking of? It'll come to me anyway. Go on.
I don't know. I mean, they did songs like Don't Go Chasing Waterfalls.
Right.
And No Scrubs.
Righto.
So, punk is not a word you'd ever apply to, no, to TLC. We mentioned them in the interest of completeness, not enthusiasm.
Yes, I mean,
to be fair, there's an awful lot of better stuff coming up in the next week or so. Stevie Nicks is going to be playing in the next week as our
with
Take
Pretenders.
That. Absolutely, yeah. Take That are playing in Auckland on Wednesday of this week, then Harry Styles at the end of the week. Cat Stevens is going to be playing very shortly with his opening act, Yusuf. And then we've got... sorry. And then... couple of weeks away from Paul McCartney being here, so we've got an interesting wrapping up of the year. I've spoilt for choice. It's going to be a good one.
Lovely. Okay, fantastic. Thank you for that roundup. So we better move on. We've had a good old yarn in our 50th episode of this podcast. Who would have thought it, eh?
I know.
Still standing after 50 podcasts.
They never said we'd do it. They never said we should. They didn't think we should do it, but
we proved them wrong. Anyway, we'd love to hear from you. I hope you've enjoyed the chat, and if you've got anything to say to us, it's always good to get some feedback from you. You can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter or indeed on Instagram these days. We're branching out at Crave Podcast.
Lovely. So, I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
Not bad.
Oh, that was a good bit.